Ephesians 5, 15 through 17, printed in your program, and reading as follows. Therefore, be careful how you walk, not as unwise men, but as wise, making the most of your time, because the days are evil. So then do not be foolish, but understand what the will of the Lord is. Would you pray with me for just a moment as we begin to look at this passage? Calm now our hearts, Father. Make us, by your Spirit, ready to receive the truth of your word. Make us obedient to what we hear, and make us joyful in the making of the opportunities that you set before us and in walking wisely before us as we seek to do what you would have us do as your people. Come, Holy Spirit, use my words for your glory, I pray. Amen. There are, I want to propose to you, three issues in this text, this brief three verses, three issues that are worthy of your attention this morning. The first is that we are told to walk carefully. The second is that we are told to walk wisely. And the third is that we are told to walk understanding what is the will of the Lord for us. First, we are told to walk carefully. Walking is a key word in the book of Ephesians. It appears perhaps 7 or 8 times in this book. It is a very key word because it connotes the idea of motion. It connotes the idea of movement in our lives. The New International Version, the version that's in our pew Bibles and the version that many of you have, translates the word walk, live, to live. And I believe that at this particular point in the book of Ephesians, the NIV translators have let us down. Because the word is not to live, it is to walk. Now, there's nothing wrong with the idea of seeking to live wisely, carefully, understanding what the Lord's will is. Indeed, that's part of what is meant here. But there's more meant by the word walk than simply to live. Live is a much more general word, isn't it? To walk means to move through something, to be going in a direction. At least that's what I think of when I hear the word walk. When you think about it in the context of the whole of the Bible tells us that we are sojourners. The Bible tells us that we are all walking through this life. The Bible tells us that we are on our way to a destination. And that destination is a better place. It's a far better place than this earth. As the old Negro spiritual puts it, this ain't my home. I'm just a walking through. And really, that's the notion that the book of Ephesians is attempting to gather together in several strands and threads with this idea of walking, that we are walking towards Zion. As the old hymnal puts it, we are walking towards our eternal home. We are walking toward a better place. And the burden of this book, of the Apostle Paul's, this letter that he wrote, is to try to get us to understand that the direction toward which we are walking is worthy of the effort of our walk. It is worthy of the effort of our labor. It is worthy of our strenuous exercise. Do you watch those people as they do their power walks in the morning? I am still baffled as to how you get enough exercise doing that. But I gather that if you sort of pump and walk hard enough, you can actually get, according to the articles, you can get your heart beating virtually as fast as you do as when some of us jog. Well, walking is intended, I suppose, to get our hearts beating. But our hearts are to be beating for something that is worthy of our walk. And the worthiness of our walk as God's people is the destination. And I've said this to you before in other contexts, even on recent Sunday mornings. This world is not the end. And I use the word end not in the sense of a temporal end, but it's not the point of it all. God intends to redeem a people out of this world for his own possession so that we might be the people of God who will be with him forever. His end, his purpose, is that there would be a redeemed humanity and that living for and in and by and through Jesus Christ, this redeemed humanity would live as salt and light in such a way that this world and the world order that is characteristic of this planet would be transformed. And you and I are the agents of that transformation. We are the salt and the light. And the problem comes, of course, when we as people don't just go passing through, but we act as if we're here to stay. And when we begin to lay down the stakes of our life on this planet in such a way that we really believe this is our reward. A good life, an opportunity to succeed, the acquiring of a sufficient amount of goods that we can relax. This life is not God's end for you. There is something far better, far richer. It begins now in knowing Jesus Christ, in walking with Christ through this life. And it will culminate one day in a better world, in a better existence, which we can only imagine now in part, but which is very real. In fact, it is more real than anything in this planet. And we are to be those who walk through this life, making a blessing everywhere we go. Abraham planted a tree. You know, he was only going to be where he was, where he planted that tree for a short period of time, but he planted the tree because he was going to be a blessing wherever he was. And so too should we be a blessing for however long we are where we are, we should be a blessing in that place. But we don't mistake this place for home. We enjoy it. We take what it gives us. We rejoice in the pleasures of it. But we don't mistake it for home. We don't put down our stakes as if we really belong here. The word walk in several ways is used in the book of Ephesians to get at this idea. For example, in chapter 2, these are strong words, but hear them and think about them. Chapter 2, verse 1. And you were dead in your trespasses and sins, in which you formerly walked according to the course of this world. Paul says that you walked in death. You were dead in your trespasses and sins. That before Jesus Christ came to our lives, we were actually dead. We were not just weak. We were not just feeble. We were not just encumbered with sin. We were not just overwhelmed with a little bit of wrong in our lives. The Bible actually portrays people as dead people apart from the grace of Christ and the gospel. And only when Christ comes to us by his grace and in his grace and quickens our hearts and makes us alive with him, only then can we walk out of death and into life. But this death, Paul says, is characterized by the course of this world. It is a world system. He goes on to say it is according to the prince of the power of the air, the spirit that is now at work in the sons of disobedience. There is, as it were, an entire environment of death. And we do beautiful things to this environment. We give beautiful flowers to make it beautiful. We have beautiful lawns and gardens, and we make beautiful communities, and we attempt to plant a tree as we walk. But we don't mistake the beauty of this place for our home. He goes on in Ephesians chapter 4, verse 17, he says, "This I say therefore and affirm together with the Lord, that you walk no longer as the Gentiles also walk in the futility of their mind." He's saying that apart from God, apart from Christ, our thinking is so desensitized, so futile, so inaccurate is our thinking that we do not perceive spiritual reality correctly. We do not perceive the world around us correctly, Paul is saying. And in contrast, then, in chapter 4, verse 1, he says, I therefore now, the prisoner of the Lord, entreat you to walk in a manner worthy of the calling with which you have been called. In other words, walk according to the calling with which you've been called. Walk according to the Christ who has called you. Walk with the Christ who has called you into this world. Chapter 5, verse 1, therefore be imitators of God as beloved children and walk in love just as Christ loved you. So what does it mean to be worthy of God's calling? It means in part that we walk in love as imitators of God himself. Chapter 5, verse 8, for you were formerly darkness, but now you are light in the Lord. Walk as children of the light. The word walk, in other words, is to suggest that there is a contrast between those who walk according to the course of this world and those who walk as children of the light. And Paul is trying to suggest in this epistle that there is an absolute contrast between the two. That there is a contrast as severe as the contrast of the darkest dark of night when there's no stars and no moon and the brightest of noonday sun. That contrast is stark and absolute between those who walk according to the course of this world and those who walk as children of the light. There is a contrast between the world and the church. But, and here is the burden of what I want you to hear, we blur that contrast again and again and again. It's ironic, in the truest sense of the word ironic, which means it would be funny if it was not so sad, that what we actually spend our times doing, dear friends, is we seek to blur the distinctiveness of the church and the world. We attempt to blur the lines of distinction between the church and the world. Now, sometimes this may appear to be a good thing. For example, kids wear T-shirts today. Christian kids wear T-shirts today that say things like, be like Christ. And in the back is a big scripture verse. And they go to school wearing that T-shirt. I think that's pretty good. I'm glad that they do that. Maybe that's a way in which the distinctiveness of the church and the world being blurred is a good blurring. But there are other ways. When the church looks for all the world, like all the world, trying to get all the world, and those lines should not be blurred. There are ways in which we have the same values, the ways in which we spend our time precisely the same way, ways in which we think and act and move and seek to acquire in precisely the same patterns. Ways in which we seek to dress and adorn ourselves, ladies, in precisely the same way as the world. When God's word is abundantly clear that the adornment that beautifies a woman of God is not in her outward splendor. And men, there are ways in which for all the world, we seek all the world in the possessions we seek to possess, in the way we use our time, and we just don't think. How are we to be distinct from the world? Children of light should be different. The light of Christ needs to shine through us. You remember when you were a child and you went camping? I went camping once as a child. That was enough. You remember how you would take a flashlight and you would open your mouth and put your lips all around the outer edge of the flashlight so that it would glow inside and you would sort of look kind of weird, like a monster, as it were, with the light coming through your cheeks. You remember that? In a silly way, that's what we as Christians are to be like. The light of Christ is to shine through us. But the light of Christ can't get through because the adornments and the values and the outer outer garments, not just the physical ones, but the whole way we think and move and walk, are so defined by the world that the world cannot see Christ in us. And so I say to my young friends who wear t-shirts to school that say, "Be like Christ." Great, wear the t-shirt, but more importantly, under the t-shirt, be like Christ. Don't just wear the t-shirt. Here in chapter 5, verse 15, be careful how you walk. Literally, look carefully how you walk. It's the same idea as looking carefully before you cross a busy street. When you cross a busy street, what do? You look carefully. You go, you look one way, you look the other way. Then you go back and you look the first way. Then you check out the second way one more time, and then you decide carefully when to walk. In light of the threat of the blurring of distinctiveness between the church and the world, walk carefully. That's what Paul's saying. We take care over so many things in our lives, so many things that mean a lot to us, our jobs, our education, our social life, our dress, our sports. The call here is to take care concerning our walk before the Lord in the world. At age 28, Jonathan Edwards devised 70 personal resolutions which he determined before God to keep all his life. And they were very detailed. They were things like that he promised that he would in no way ever adorn his outward life in a way by his possessions that would somehow in any way compromise the clarity of Christ working through his life. In other words, he would never become so encumbered by what he possessed that Christ could not use him and shine through him. And I want to suggest for us that we should have a mild and persistent discomfort in this world. Have you ever bought a suit or a lady's dress that you shouldn't have bought because it didn't fit quite right? And you knew men in the store, you know, when you were getting fitted for that suit and it was being put on, you knew it didn't just fit right. You liked the looks of it. It was a great suit, but it didn't fit right. You shouldn't buy it. You got it home, you knew you shouldn't buy it. And the rest of the years that you own that suit, you hardly ever wear it because you think, I shouldn't have bought this suit. It doesn't fit right. And you're kind of mildly uncomfortable in that suit. That's the way we should be in this world. Mildly uncomfortable. Sometimes we should be profoundly uncomfortable. We are to walk with care in this world, minding that there is a difference between the church and the world. Second, and quite briefly, we are to walk wisely. The passage says not only walk carefully, but walk wisely. Care is really equated with wisdom here. It's wise to be careful how we walk. Now, in the Bible, wisdom is always practical. It always teaches us to live in light of our truest and deepest identity. I was meeting once with a group of educators and business people and pastors in the city of Dallas a few years ago now. And we were listing values that we wanted to instill in the children of Dallas. And those values we listed, we had a board and we thought we were doing great work. Honesty, fairness, industry, hard work. We listed about 10 such values. And one dear black pastor finally didn't say anything. And finally he said, "You know what? I know gangs in the city of Dallas that would list that same list of qualities." You see, holding to values is not what it means to have wisdom. It's living those values that is wise. That's the way the Bible puts it. In the Bible, wisdom is always to be lived out. I remember one friend I had who used to work in the south, southeast corner of Manhattan. He said, "You can't just talk the talk, you gotta walk the walk." Wisdom is not an intellectual achievement. I've told you before of a gate I used to enter at Harvard every year, every day, practically in 4 years of education, I would walk through a gate and it would say, "Enter and grow in wisdom." And I often wondered, am I growing in wisdom? Even as a 19 and 20-year-old kid, I wondered, am I growing in wisdom? And I wasn't. Knowledge maybe, but not necessarily wisdom. Wisdom in the Bible, especially in the Old Testament, is an attitude toward life characterized by two things. One, a personal knowledge of God, and two, avoidance of all that displeases Him. And Paul says that we are to walk wisely by making the most of our time. And literally that word means to redeem or buy back our time, to ransom it from inappropriate or wrong use. He could have said make the most of your life, but by using the word time, he focuses on the notion of opportunities. The world would have us spend our time in certain ways, but the gospel of Jesus Christ bids us to buy back the time and use it for the Lord. This is more than a proof text for good time management. It's calling to see our lives as wonderful opportunities. There's an ad in the newspaper, I suppose, somewhat facetiously put once, "Lost yesterday, somewhere between sunrise and sunset, 2 golden hours, each set with 60 diamond minutes. No reward offered, for they are gone forever." You see, when you think about the worship and work of your life in this church, it is not your money so much that the Lord wants. He wants you to buy back the opportunities that are according to your giftedness, that are according to the way the Lord has made you. And He wants you to seize the opportunities that are before us and to use our time as the people of God individually and corporately. I was talking to Barbara about this morning, and she reminded me of, I'll go ahead and say her name because it's a wonderful compliment, Becky Bain. Dear sister in the Lord in our church, who literally goes through her life looking for the wounded birds, the hurt doves, the people who need some attention that she can give them. Now, Becky does lots of things. She has lots of fun. She raises 3 beautiful kids. She's a wonderful wife to her husband, but in the process, she is buying back the time for God by saying, "My life is for Him, not for the world." We are to seek to do that which is most profitable with our time. You've heard the term in economics, an opportunity cost. I had a friend who was a professor of economics at the University of Virginia. He taught me what that means. It means that when you spend your money or your time on one thing, the cost of spending your time or money on that thing is that you don't spend it on something else. And so there is an opportunity cost to everything that we do. And we are to be careful to use our time most profitably. Why? Because Paul says in this text, because the days are evil. Now, what does he mean by that? It sounds like something that should be on a placard. You know, some guy with a beard and scruffy clothes should be walking up and down the street. The days are evil. The days are evil. How do we hear that? What does that mean for us? Are they any more evil than the days that existed 50 or 100 or 500 years ago? Perhaps what evil days are illustrated best by a conversation I had yesterday. And you know, in God's providence, He sometimes does that for me. When I'm getting ready to say something to you, He gives me an illustration of it. One of you approached me at a child's athletic event yesterday. And I was sort of resting for a few moments. I was sitting down at this event with my eyes closed, kind of like this, catching a few rays, I suppose. And you came up to me and you said, "Working on your sermon, Skip?" And then she said, "What are you preaching on?" And I said, "Walk wisely, for the days are evil." And you said, with great insight and discernment, "You know, we don't really walk through our lives thinking that the days are evil. But when something happens to us, like we get sick, or there's a financial reversal, or something happens that we wish wouldn't happen, we begin to realize the stuff that these days are made of. You see, the days are evil because the world is a fallen world. Because the world is not the world God made and meant it to be, brothers and sisters. It's not a perfect place. It's a very imperfect place. And you and I are representatives of the perfect one who came into this imperfect place to redeem it. And so we must look more like him than the imperfect world. Mahatma Gandhi was raised in South Africa, not in India, as most people think. There's a large Indian population in South Africa. In South Africa, he was exposed to Christianity, for Christianity is really the dominant faith of South Africa. And when he was older, and of course not at all a Christian, he was asked once, "Mahatma, why are you not a Christian?" And he said, "I would consider becoming a Christian were I to see the ones who followed the Christ looking more like their master." Walk carefully in your worship and work. Choose carefully what you do in this church. I'll finish the sermon next week, but just for now, you think about this, would you? Think about what it means to walk through this life with the Lord as your vision. With the Lord as the one who guides our way. With the Lord as the end, the goal, the perfecter. And, may I add, the joy of our lives. So that nothing or no one replaces the central place in our hearts that he gives us there and that he provides for us there. That he would be our joy and nothing else. And by God's grace, may we be a people collectively as the church that don't look like the world, but do in fact look more like our master.